The fields that flank Old Deerfield belong to Sandy Williams and his family, who continue to work the land as generations before them have done.
Well, it's probably the best soil in the world. It's a Hadley loam. Most of it is, and there's some sandy loam.
Williams's father inherited this land from his grandparents, who farmed here in the early 1900s. Behind the spinning blades of the tractor, a line of deep, rich earth unfurls like a ribbon of dark velvet.
And then you can work it. I mean, you get an inch of rain and you can go in the next day and work the ground. So it's, you know, it drains well, you know, and no rocks.
One look and you begin to see why this fertile soil has been coveted by so many. Centuries earlier, native groups had also identified this strip along the Connecticut and Deerfield rivers as prime land for growing maize, beans, squash, and tobacco. The waters were plentiful with trout and other fish. For thousands of years, these natives, called the Pocumtuck Indians by the English, practiced a traditional subsistence agriculture that allowed them to use the land without depleting it. And this, in turn, gave them the freedom to move throughout a wide territory they knew as their homeland. Historian Kevin Sweeney is co-author of Captors and Captives, the 1704 French and Indian Raid on Deerfield, which re-examines the events of 1704.
The image of natives as strictly nomadic is misleading in the sense that they wandered aimlessly. They did not. They tended to have villages in certain areas. They would plant corn, and then they would move particularly into upland or inland regions where they could hunt. In April, they would often take advantage of fish runs at various falls. So it was a set round, if you will.
The Deerfield and Connecticut rivers, which shaped and enriched this land, were also critical travel routes. This traditional Wabanaki paddling song might well have been heard on the river 300 years ago. It's a favorite of historian and Abenaki Indian Marge Bruchak, who paddles her canoe along the shores of the Connecticut, still dense today with corn and other crops.
So this whole region was inhabited and traveled regularly. So when you came down the Connecticut River, you'd find put-in places, you'd find stores of corn. I mean, even as we paddle now, you can look alongside the river and see plants like Joe Pye weed and jewelweed.
By the 1600s, the surrounding forests still yielded beaver, bear, and fox for a lively fur trade between the natives and the Europeans who had recently arrived. But several forces would play a critical role in what happened next. Among them, a decline in the native population brought on by European-born diseases.
In the 1630s, an epidemic, believed to be smallpox, swept through the Connecticut Valley.
Historian Kevin Sweeney.
There seems to be fairly good evidence about what the death toll was, which may have been in the realm of 90%.
Later, the Pocumtuck were attacked by their Iroquois and Mohawk neighbors, which left even more dead. After a land dispute in 1665, the colonial government granted the town of Dedham, just south of Boston, 8,000 acres of land anywhere in the region. The Dedham surveyors set their sights on the lands of the Pocumtuck. Though most of the natives had dispersed to join other native groups, they had planned on returning. Scholars, including Kevin Sweeney, agree the landscape still bore the clear signs of native presence.
So there would have been evidence of the clearing the natives have done, probably of their cornfields, maybe even to some extent remnants of their habitations. And so that, in that sense, yes, the native presence was visible, though the English would have looked upon it as probably divinely created vacant land. I mean, this they would have seen, as they did in so many things, the hand of providence, that God had cleared the land for them.
Many historians today say this blind spot in the colonial mindset served the settlers' appetite for acquiring more and more land in what they perceived as wilderness. A 1949 film made by Deerfield Academy offers a typical view of colonial expansion as it was perceived only 50 years ago.
North of Hadley, an unbroken wilderness stretched to Montreal. This part of the valley was inhabited then only by the feeble remnant of the once proud and powerful Pocumtuck tribe. We see now one of the last of these Indian families preparing to leave their home here for the security and protection they hoped to find in the towns to the south.
They likely did not, as the film depicts, fold their teepees and give a friendly wave goodbye to the English. There were land negotiations, but historians now say the natives were manipulated through dubious trade agreements that ultimately left the land in the hands of the settlers. As the displaced natives moved north, they found a French military eager to capitalize on their anger, and by 1704, several native groups became players in a war between England and France, both seeking control of North America. Patrick Côté is curator of the Abenaki Museum in Quebec. Côté says the natives of the Pecumtuck Valley understood that their new allies could, at the very least, help keep the British at bay.
They couldn't strategically retake the valley, but putting a doubt in the British colonists' minds that we can come down here and wreak havoc whenever we wish.
The violence came on February 29, 1704. French militia and natives used the drifted snowbanks to slide over the stockade fence that protected the town. About one-third of the population was killed. 112 men, women, and children were taken captive and marched through the snow to Canada.
One of the things that makes interpreting this story so difficult is the fact that the dominant perspective on 1704 has always been the English perspective. What are these Indians doing here? What is the experience of the captives? What is it like to be in a town that's being burned and attacked? And it's so difficult to lay out the groundwork that puts that conflict into perspective.
What's clear is that the lives of many colonists and natives would be dramatically altered forever. And the retelling of this story for centuries to come would reveal as much about the teller as the story itself. For WFCR, I'm Susanna Lee.